Hello and welcome back, everybody, or welcome here for the very first time. This is Volcanology, a podcast all about how volcanoes interact across nature, culture, art, media, and society. My name's Sam Mitchell. Hello to those of you who are coming back. And also with me today is Hugh James, our producer for the podcast. Hello, Hugh.
Hey, Sam. It's good to be back on the actual podcast, having edited season two, listened to everything, and had a really good season one as well. Fantastic to be back on.
Yeah, good. And that's exactly where we're at right now. We've finished all the recordings for series two, so we've already had a listen. We know what's to come. And within this episode today, we'll also do a bit of a recap and a review of what we learned in season one, some of our highlights, some of our favorite bits, and then some of the excitement about what's to come. And so for those of you who are joining for the very first time, we've got some fantastic things back from the previous season. So the idea behind this podcast was to show the other side of volcanoes, how volcanoes really do intersect and interact across those different areas of society, not just how we research volcanoes, but how they influence our culture, our artistry, our media. And so I think a lot of the first season, we really delved into lots of different locations and exploration, and maybe talk about indigenous communities, talking about the depths of the ocean, going out to the stars. So there was a real exploration value, I think, which I hope is a great way to get people engaged in this subject.
It is, because, you know, living in a place that doesn't have any active volcanoes, but, you know, the British Isles in general has plenty of volcanic rocks, but not any active volcanoes. Same as glaciers, it's hard to think about something that's not something you interact with on a daily basis. So, you know, through that season one, go into these different locations and finding out there are people that live on the slopes of volcanoes, that interact with them in different ways, that live inside calderas and places like the Azores. Like, people do live with volcanoes, and I think that really came across in season one.
Yeah, it's something that is always come across, you know, when I'm talking to people about this or at events, or people asking, particularly during a crisis or during an event that they see on the news, why would people live by volcanoes? And it's a very loaded question. There's not one simple answer. Some of it is down to the land that's physically available for people to live on. Some of it's down to agricultural reasons. But a lot of it comes down to history, and particularly indigenous and native narratives. So you can find this in examples in Hawaii, in the all across the Southwest Pacific as well, in small island nations around there. There's so many different reasons why people may live around volcanoes. And that's why I think it's really important to showcase, you know, what people bring about through this, you know, the stories they produce, the artistry that comes about from these communities. And it's something we'll touch a lot more on in season two. From some of the episodes is, you know, what those stories are. So storytelling from the local people, how scientists communicate with the local people as well.
And, you know, for our listeners in the UK, I know that we've had listeners from across the world for season one, but our listeners from the UK might remember doing that in geography. If you take geography in school up to the age of 16, one of the things you learn about in human geography, the classic example of Italy, right? Like, why people live around volcanic regions in the south of Italy compared to the north of Italy. What are the differences between the agriculture and the economy, the north versus the south? And it's a really good case because it's really evident. Like, you have this one country with two different areas, one's volcanic and one's not. And one's a bit flatter up in the north, and one's a bit more mountainous in the south. You've got Sicily down there as well. I certainly remember that from school and being in geography lessons with Mrs. Watkins and her teaching me all about that. But it was definitely something I learned that, like, these other people did. And now, you know, through listening to season one, going out and having my own adventures, like you say, I've learned that for a lot of people, it's just daily life.
Yeah, exactly. And the most important part is listening and showcasing those local stories, because sometimes those aren't the stories that are told. We actually covered a lot of this in one of the episodes in season one with Jasmine Scarlett, which was about, like, history and heritage, particularly around Le Soufriere volcano and St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and how what we have learnt about that volcano is actually so rooted in speaking to the people who have lived there for hundreds of years. That's where the scientific information is. We need to remember, of course, scientific data is not just physical data that you collect by a big expensive scientific instrument or somebody out in the field looking at rocks all the time. Yes, those are important, but physical stories and narratives are scientific data as well.
Yeah, they are. And you know, I've loved listening to them through season one, going the opposite way to some of the more abstract stuff. My favorite episode, I think, was Natalie Starkey, the very last episode of season one, because my background is more in planetary geology than I was going to say real geology. it's more in it was in astronomy and space science and geology. So I loved studying why are the planets acting the way that they do in terms of geology. And hers was all about volcanism on other planets. And you know, we're always learning new stuff, even with data that we've collected years ago. So that, you know, this year we had a great story kind of prompted because we've got a new satellite that's going to Venus pretty soon, the Veritas mission. And through that, Robert Hendrick went back and said, okay, from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, went back and said, okay, we do have lots of data already collected on this from the Magellan missions. Is there anything there that we can study? So he went back to find out, is there any, because we've thought that there's active volcanoes on Venus for so long. Like when I studied it, there's this idea of planetary wide reforming of the surface of Venus that we've never been able to prove. We've never even proved that there's volcanology on the surface of Venus until this year. He went through 200 hours just manually comparing photo to photo, and found that in this one region, it looks like that there's active volcanology in that region. So Natalie's, the very last podcast of season one, Natalie's podcast really rang true with me this year, because we're still finding out new stuff about our solar system and volcanology.
Yeah, and even using the existing data, the Magellan missions from the 90s, you know, we're only talking 20 to 30 years ago.
Oh my God, so the 90s were 30 years ago.
Sorry. So, you know, when we talk about historical records for, you know, going back hundreds of years, even going back to data sets that are only a couple of decades old, we can still learn from those, because obviously the technology we have to analyze imagery in any way, shape or form, not just in volcanology and earth science, but in any way, shape or form using AI, machine learning, the amount we can learn just from what we already have is astounding. And there's so much research across science, which is going back and looking at those. But now to know that we're also going back to the planet and in a number of missions over the coming decade is just so, so exciting for geologists, atmospheric scientists, you know, the potential for biosignatures that have been potentially found in Venus's atmosphere as well. All of it's an incredibly exciting time for planetary science.
Yeah, I think planetary geology and planetary volcanology is going to go through a bit of a change in the next few decades. Like literally today, the day that we're recording this, the Psyche mission is hopefully launching. That's going to be studying a special kind of asteroid that is made of almost entirely of metal. It could have been an old planetary core of some sort in our solar system. So this idea, you know, we go back to Lord Kelvin saying, you know, science is finished. Like we've got so much to learn. It's crazy. And I think there's never been a time where less money's been going to science, I don't think, but more stuff is being found out. And I think with more volcanologists and geologists coming through, they're going to be looking to the stars. And more is going to be done on Mars and Venus and Io and Europa, you know, some great missions going on there. And I don't want to take up too much time for a volcanology podcast about space science, but I just think it's going to be really exciting in the next few decades.
Yeah, I think this is something I mentioned in Natalie's episode as well. Something that always struck me for Venus is that the surface of Venus is the same pressure as about 900 meters in our oceans. And so for me personally, a lot of my research is focused on studying volcanoes in our oceans. And ironically, one of the ones I studied for my PhD is at 900 meters below sea level. And so that's something I was always remembering, is that how this volcano is erupting at a much higher pressure, which is about 90 atmospheres, so 90 times surface pressure. is actually the exact same pressure that you would experience if you were standing on the surface of Venus. Obviously, there's a whole lot of differences between the temperature of the atmosphere and you're erupting into a basically a supercritical carbon dioxide soup instead of water or air. But
that's at hundreds
that
of hundreds
comparison
of degrees
across
as well.
Two different planets. Yeah, yeah, the temperature as well. But the fact that these two systems are actually at the same pressure, can we actually use what we're learning about our seafloor to learn about Venus? But also the other way around, as we learn more about Venus, can we learn more about our seafloor? You know, we've still only, the latest numbers are about 23 to 25% of our seafloor has been sufficiently mapped now. So the numbers are climbing and there's still a mission to map 100% of the ocean seafloor by 2030. And so that is still, it's still a long way to go, but we are making progress in that area.
I mean, that's like 7 years, less than 7 years time. Now it's going to be 6 years time.
Less than 7 years time. But yeah, the Seabed 2030 project kicked off, I think about 2016, 2017. And at the time, the numbers were only 5%. Now that's not to say we've added all that data in that time. It's been a lot of compiling of what maybe people haven't necessarily shared or made publicly available. Anyway, I feel like I'm going on a tangent now myself. You've had your space moment. I've had my seafloor moment. Okay. Let's get back to the podcast as well. Yeah, so just kind of going through some of the stuff we covered in season one. We've covered Natalie's episode really well. We mentioned Jasmine's episode about history and heritage in the Eastern Caribbean. There were so many great episodes that were around there during that time. So we talked with Christopher Jackson, who's been really, really publicly basically on the public platforms, giving really fantastic public lectures and doing a lot as well for tackling racism in geoscience and a whole lot of diversity issues. But talking to him about expeditions, he was out in Democratic Republic of Congo, a Nyiragongo volcano. So that was really, really fantastic. We went down to lava lakes and to the seafloor, talking about microbes with Dr. Jeffrey Marlowe. That was a really, really fantastic episode.
One of my favorite episodes was Signals and Sounds with Leif Karlström.
With Leif. That was something really, really unique. I've known Leif for a number of years, and his work of turning volcanic and geophysical data into not just sounds but music, and trying to actually use that to learn about volcanoes, because a lot of the time we're just looking at graphs on a sheet of paper. We're comparing graph A with graph B and trying to look for patterns, but probably one of our better senses is our hearing for trying to blend different signals and sounds. That's why we enjoy music, because it's that blend of different frequencies and pitches and instruments. And so that's really where they're aiming to go for that. How can we use different sensory learning to actually look at science?
Yeah, and I was part of the team probably like 2007, working with the gravitational wave theory team in Cardiff University, who was doing something very similar with black holes at the time, and looking at how can they made a game from it that we would take out to schools, and it was, you can listen to black holes colliding and converging. And this is how we get gravitational waves from them. And that was in a time where it was just a theory, since being proven true, which was a really exciting time. But this idea of taking data and forming it into a different way of thinking and learning really came through in Leif's episode. So it's just so much good stuff. We should all just go back and maybe we should have a listen party and just like sit down and listen to all them back to back.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, that I don't particularly like going back and listening to my own voice, but you know, I'm forced to, because at some point I have to listen back to these episodes. So I just kind of put my fingers in my ears when I'm talking and then just listen to the guests. I'm slowly getting more used to it. But then some other things we came across, talking about performance as well. We started to delve a bit into the arts as well. So we talked about how you can potentially use things like dance to actually convey different volcanological concepts. That was with Chensu Chula. We talked, that was also came about in Diamond Takera's episode, which was focused on Hawaiian storytelling. And a lot of that is incorporated into hula. So a lot of volcanic knowledge in the Hawaiian Islands is rooted in native traditions, one of those being the native hula of and hula dance, which a lot of people might have their own perceptions on from, you know, TV, movies and media. But there's, at the end of the day, it's a way of expressing their connection with the environments and the processes that have shaped Hawaiian culture for like 2000 years. So delved into those little bits of history as well, which I absolutely love.
Yeah. And yeah, it's not a recent thing that people have been living with volcanoes and telling stories about them. It's just, we have new tools now to be doing that with social media and the likes, and everything's a bit more, I don't know, a bit more accessible, and a bit more immediate to start sharing those stories. But people have been living with volcanoes and telling these stories for years. So I'm really excited about these new ways of, you know, with volcanic activity continuing to go on, in different ways and forms. People are going to continue to tell these stories. And in next season, there's a few episodes we talk about, like gaming and other stuff, which are just different ways of telling those stories that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I said, this focus almost not away from exploration, but into the people. You know, I always wanted to make this podcast as a connection across society. So now we're delving into populations and actual the cultures and the stories that people are telling, which is really, really exciting. So as you say, talking about gaming, we're talking about people's inspirational roots. One of our guests grew up inside on a ranch inside a volcanic caldera, and at the time didn't really know what that was, what it meant, and then spent their time away and came back and is now actually working on the volcanics of that system. So, you know, just wonderful stories about how people have come into this life themselves, and then also what they want to give back.
Yeah, and also making sure that we include different people's voices in those stories as well. So, you know, talking about, are there volcanoes in places like Australia and the power of indigenous Aboriginal knowledge there? That was a fantastic episode that I think that will stay with me for a long time, that these people who have lived there for generations and generations and generations just have an intimate knowledge of things that people visiting, even scientists, won't ever fully understand, I don't think.
Exactly, yeah. And so, yeah, there's a teaser for all of you. We are going to Australia. Did you know there are actually volcanoes in Australia? How often they erupt and how when the last one erupted, I guess you'll have to find out in that episode. But yeah, hopefully touching on some stuff that people have never even heard about before. And then a lot of it also comes down to communication, because we can learn so much as scientists, whether it's through scientific data from instruments, from storytelling, as we said before. But then if we can't communicate that to the public and we can't also train other people how to talk about that, then science just ends. Because it has to be able to translate to the public, but also future generations of scientists. And so there's a couple of episodes where we also touch on that as well, which is the power of, one, teaching in your normal kind of school setting, in your college, community college in the USA through the university system, but then also communication through local communities and local outreach, which is something I absolutely love. Every time I go into a school classroom surrounded by maybe say 35 or 6 year olds and tell them about how there are volcanoes where penguins walk around, and you can just see the light in their eyes when they just click with a few facts. It's so, so important that we make sure that information is accessible on all levels.
I think it was the late great Carl Sagan that said that science not communicated is science not finished. And, you know, we believe a lot in that. And it's one of the reasons we do this podcast. But scientists in general, I think I'm always taken aback by how willing scientists are to take the time to share their science. Like, they're some of the busiest people you'll ever come across in your life, but are always willing to sit down and talk. You ask them about their science and they will keep you there for 3 hours talking about it, because they're so passionate about it. And I think one of the things that comes through in next season for me is how they've all been, that passion has come from a lot of the time their interaction with volcanoes, that they've seen one for the first time, or they they grew up in one, or there's some kind of interaction and that sparked a curiosity in them that has stayed to this day. You know, kids are, like you say, kids are curious. They like learning things. And if you keep that with you until you grow up, you end up becoming a scientist. I think that really comes across in the next season.
Exactly. So sometimes I feel almost a bit of an imposter because I hear these stories, you know, of people who grew up in the site of a volcano, or they went on holiday to Mount Etna when they were 5 or 6 years old, and that's all they ever wanted to do ever since. I actually found my route into science from an interest in tsunamis and earthquakes. So still in the realm of natural hazards, but it wasn't actually volcanoes that was that immediate click of interest. I actually, unfortunately, to my memory, I can't remember when that switch was. I think it was actually quite passive. I was interested in tsunamis following the 2004 Indonesian Boxing Day tsunami. And I was just taken aback by the raw power of the planet and how something so quick and instantaneous could have so much potential damage and impact across the entire world. And so at that point, I think I just found an inherent love for the planet and the processes around it. And slowly over time, I guess I switched from the water to the things where hot things come out. But then ironically, I actually found myself becoming an ocean scientist in the end. So I've kind of come full circle now.
Yeah, I think mine actually was when I was quite young. I just have a vivid memory of, for some reason in geography with Mrs. Watkins, we had to do a presentation. I don't know what it was about. I ended up doing mine on Mount Etna. And this was long enough ago that all the stuff, the internet didn't exist. We had to get all our information from Microsoft Encarta. And I remember printing my presentation out. I think I did it in Microsoft Publisher and printing it out on a LaserJet printer and like putting it in one of those plastic binders that you find. And my presentation on Mount Etna was ready. And that was a lovely mix, I think, for me on volcanoes and the communication of science. I must have been like 12 or 13 or something. And I just remember to this day, the front cover being like that really awful clip art that you used to get in Microsoft of a volcano with like Mount Etna written beneath it in that classic, like that classic style that you used to get in Microsoft. So yeah, it's been with me for a long time. And just hearing these new episodes come out just instills in me that passion again.
Yeah. And as you say, it's just communicating those small little facts that can make such a difference to somebody learning about this for the first time. I think I said it in the first episode of the first series. I'll say it in videos through social media, and I'll say it here again in terms of how many volcanoes are actually erupting on a daily basis, because people hear about the ones they hear about in the news. So I think there was either last year or the year before, at the same time, there was activity at Volcano, Etna, Kilauea in Hawaii, and also in Iceland at Fagradalsfjall. And they were all happening at the same time. And there was a slurry of questions coming through of saying, oh, are they all connected? Does this mean something on the planetary scale? Volcanoes are blips. They're zits. They're just little pimples on the surface of this giant factory. The connections between Iceland, Italy, and Hawaii, they don't exist. It's negligible to the size of the crust and the mantle. But it's what, you know, it's what people see in the news, and it's what they perceive. Oh, maybe global activity is going up. But what we have to remember is actually at any one point in time, there's probably around 20 to 30 volcanoes erupting on the planet at once. And most of these are in remote places that, you know, there are no populations, there are no people. They're in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. They're in Kamchatka in Russia. They're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. They're on the seafloor. And so most of the volcanoes that are erupting never actually even make the news. So the ones that do make the news end up getting a lot of attention. But it's only a small part of a much bigger story.
Yeah, I remember we just moved into a new house, and my builder, who's lovely, was going to Hawaii. I think it was last year's eruption, actually. And I remember texting him because he was on the news going, "Ah, if you're in Hawaii, you should definitely go visit the volcano. It doesn't happen for a while, and it might not happen again for a while. You should go and see it." And he was like, "What volcano? What's going on?" So even when it's like big news, unless you're slightly tuned into it, you can just miss it.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we have a bias to the media and the news that we want to see. So I know that my phone will always blow up when there's, you know, some big scientific news or something in geology, because that's obviously what my algorithms and my phone is streamlined to do. But there's a whole slew of things that don't come through. And not just what volcanoes are erupting in a single place, but around 50 to 60 different volcanoes will erupt over the course of a single year. And even for somewhere like Hawaii, for Kilauea volcano, which from 1983 was continuously active until 2018, and that was an incredible period of time. Then it stopped erupting, but then came back in 2020, and now has just been coming on and off ever since. But then literally on the exact same island, Mauna Loa volcano, which is, I think, less than 10 miles from Kilauea volcano, erupted for the first time since 1984. And that was last year in 2022. And so that was a complete change of perspective for people living on the island, and also for the scientists. There are people who moved to the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, you know, desperate for something to happen at Mauna Loa so they could learn more, but so it would hopefully be contained and not affect anyone. And that's actually what happened, thankfully. It was a relatively small eruption contained upon the slopes of the mountains, but the first time that volcano had erupted in 38 years. And so it was just, it was an incredible moment, one for the scientists, but for the people as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't have the funds to take me all around the world, to Hawaii for it, but my builder was there. But I did, I probably should have gone again to Fagradalsfjall to, because that's erupted a bunch of times the last couple of years. And it's pretty close. It's like 3 hours away from the UK. And seeing the, that's one of the things I've really enjoyed about this new wave of social media. I don't enjoy everything about social media. I enjoy very little about social media. But one of the things I've loved is seeing people get, okay, people get in, having an interaction. You know, we talk about interactions, and all these scientists in season two have had those. I've enjoyed people having that interaction and learning more about volcanoes. There's some stuff in season two about why you shouldn't probably get too close. And we've definitely seen that as well. Fagradalsfjall is really close to civilizations, and it means you can get a little bit too close to it. But again, I missed it because I just had a little bit too much work on, you know, couldn't justify going that way just to see the volcano. If it goes again, this is my promise to you, the listeners, and myself, I'm going to go. I'm going to drop everything.
There we go.
I'm just going to go.
What? I have also not been. So this has been 3 years in a row now. And the timing between the initiation of each of those episodes has actually been quite steady. And it's a subject that actually one of our guests wrote a very good article. So I think they'll be coming up in the, one of the first few episodes. They wrote a fantastic article talking about the timings between eruptions. And is three eruptions a pattern? Scientifically, no. But it's an interesting question. You know, this single volcano that's been dormant for 800 years, around that amount of time, suddenly erupts three times over 3 years. And, you know, it's one of the questions that scientists are looking at. So will we expect another eruption at Fagradalsfjall in 2024? Well, we actually don't know. It's not a solid question. It's something the scientists will look at in detail. And we may not find out until we get the warning signs it's about to happen again. Thankfully for that eruption, it's mostly contained. And it's relatively small compared to, you know, some of these much bigger eruptions that happen. So it is that opportunity for people to learn, because volcanoes are, they're enigmatic, they're ethereal, they're a sensory overload. You know, I was speaking to a very prominent volcanologist just a few days ago, and he said when he goes and witnesses a volcanic eruption, he's not sitting there all the time thinking about the science. Sometimes he just has to sit there and go, wow. My eyes, my ears, my nose are just overloaded right now with everything that's happening. And I don't think you have to be a scientist at all to feel that raw power.
Yeah. And you can get that from so many things. Iceland weirdly has almost all of those things, glaciers and northern lights and volcanoes and huge waterfalls and that kind of stuff. But that interaction with, it's why I'm such a big proponent of traveling, even though traveling has quite a high carbon cost, I still think this interaction I'm going to say it was Da Vinci that said you can't love something if you've never interacted with it. I think it was him. It might just been someone random, but you know, that interaction. And I work a lot in the climate change circles now, and we have these role model glaciers, these like ambassadors for glaciers around the world. The Solheimjökull in Iceland is one of them. The Made of Glass I was just at in France is another one. And you have these ambassadors for the rest of them. And I feel like we have a few ambassador volcanoes. Like I said, we definitely got ambassador glaciers that we have to just say, okay, let's make this as accessible as possible so people can have this experience, like say this ethereal experience, and learn that we are but a little speck on this planet, and there's forces at work on this planet that are far above our pay grade.
Yeah, and that's touching on something that, of course, you've done a lot yourself, and it's a really great opportunity to have a very brief chat about the Athlete Climate Academy. It's something that's so relevant in talking about, you know, the impact that humans are having on the climate, but then also how that impacts our environment. So I know you've been talking both with scientists, but also athletes at the same time around a whole variety of things related to climate. So it'd be great to hear a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, you know, my work, like I said, I'm an astronomer and geologist by training, but over the last few years, I've, like all of us, I've realized that climate change is the threat that we face as humankind. Not that the planet cares that we're warming it up. It'll at some point rebalance itself, whether we're here or not. But if we want to have a stable existence going forward, that we have to do something about it. So just like we've chosen for this podcast to have a special interest in volcanoes and geology, for that one, I chose outdoor athletes, anyone who's interested in being in the outdoors. So me and a guy called Killian Shonet, who's, I would say, the best trail runner in the world. And I'm sure you won't mind me saying that, because I think it's true. We now talk to athletes and glaciologists and climate change scientists and outdoor brands as well. Like in the outdoor industry, when we make stuff to go in the outdoor industry, how are we exacerbating the problem? So it's a really nice podcast about climate change. If you look up Athlete Climate Academy on wherever you listen to your podcast, it'll probably pop up. And it's either me or Killian talking to some really interesting people about the problems that we face, and some of the misnomers that are out there as well, like the misinformation that comes along with it. I know volcanology has a few of those as well. I do get from time to time, hey, humans are bad and all, but what about volcanoes? They see these huge plumes, and Athlete Climate Academy is a place where we can say, we were in workshops and stuff as well, hey, I know that this looks like it's the problem, but actually this is the big problem, you know?
Yeah, that's a big question that always comes about. You know, people see these volcanic eruption plumes and think, how can that not be influencing climates? And yet for the most part, you know, the regular eruptions that happen around the world don't. They're tiny, tiny blips in comparison to the whole atmosphere. This number gets thrown around, oh, the atmosphere is only 0.04% carbon dioxide. That's such a tiny amount. Yes, but the atmosphere is also very, very big. Yeah. So all of these scales are relevant, and even volcanoes rarely make such an impact on climate. We have the numbers, we have the data from satellite infill measurements. Carbon dioxide from volcanoes equates to about 3%, if that, some years of human off output CO2. So it's a tiny, tiny fraction, and it's only these, you know, once every decade, once every 100-year eruptions that actually just create a little punctuation in something in the atmosphere, whether that's pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, which acts as basically a warmer, or sulfur, which actually acts as a coolant. That's usually the more likely scenario. You put sulfur in the atmosphere, it becomes sulfate, and it causes a bit of global cooling. But we've actually had a very recent experience in the past year from the 2022 Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai eruption in the Kingdom of Tonga. That eruption was so large in terms of the plume and interacted with so much seawater that it actually put one of the largest amounts of water, physical water vapor, into the atmosphere. Not just when I say the atmosphere, into the stratosphere. You know, we're talking tens and tens of kilometers high. that this material went. And it's the first time we've properly seen in satellite data that a volcanic eruption has potentially caused even a tiny bit of global warming on the grander scale of things by pumping another greenhouse gas, which is water vapor, into the atmosphere. So we didn't we hadn't seen that until last year. And so it just shows how much there is still to learn about our own interactions with climate, and then also how nature interacts with climate as well. It's complex, which is why learning and communicating about it is such a challenging subject.
Yeah, the idea of, hey, volcanoes play this huge part. You can say yes to that, but what part do they actually play? Sometimes it's warming, sometimes it's cooling. But whatever it is cool. In the scientific research and the learning of it, so I'm really excited to for people to listen to season two to interact with Volcanology and with us as well on social media.
Absolutely. So at this point, I think this is a great opportunity to almost kind of let, if you're listening a couple of weeks in, hopefully you've got a couple of episodes waiting and ready to come now. So I think we'll already have the second episode available right after this one, if not immediately. So I'm really, really excited for you all to listen to this as well. Follow along for the journey. You can find, well, you're here already, so you obviously have found the podcast in some way, but there's many different ways you can interact it. We are on Instagram. We are on the tweeting platform. We're on Twitter. You can find us on our website, and you can listen to us through through iTunes and through a whole other range that you'll find on our website as well. We also do video record these podcast episodes, so you can watch them as well at the same time if you want to put some faces to the voices that you hear. So please also head over to our Volcanology podcast YouTube channel. And I think I'm going to actually start putting some of these on the TikTok. I need to keep relevant and modern.
Well, it's good to have like a range of places for people to find this stuff. And you know, if you are listening, you like these episodes, you know, please do share them with, I think I've landed on kind of special interest for this as a thing, people who are interested in volcanoes and geology in general. And I think people who aren't interested just haven't heard enough of it yet. Like you do have in volcanology, the same when I studied space, like people just, they do like it. Like there's a thing, it's a reason Dante's Peak is one of the best films out there. It's a reason why Apollo 13 is one of the best ones out there, because it's inherently interesting, but we don't fully know why it's interesting. And I think that's what this podcast does well, is let us know why we think volcanoes are so cool.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here for this intro episode, Hugh, and also for, you know, all the work you're doing behind the scenes to make sure this keeps running as well. I really do appreciate it. And I know we've had some fantastic guests, and we've got a really great lineup coming up as well. So thank you all to listening for this first episode of Volcanology, and we hope you enjoy the rest of the series. Thank you, Hugh.
See you soon.